You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. Please take your seats. Thank you all very much for joining us this morning. We have a fascinating, excellent annual tradition. And this year, titled The Middle East, you can see yourself. Well, actually not. The Middle East and Russia, American Attitudes on Trump's Foreign Policy. And this is our annual release of data compiled, analyzed, produced by Shibli Tilhami, our non-resident senior fellow. And it's a special privilege. I'll get to that in a minute. This also is the beginning, the unofficial soft beginning, of our Saban Forum for 2017. You may have heard the news yesterday that we will be hosting a senior advisor to the president, Jared Kushner, for a public discussion on Sunday. We will have a video message from the prime minister of Israel, Justice Minister Ayelet Shaked, member of the cabinet, Tzachi Hanegbi, member of the cabinet, Ambassador Hossam Zomlot, the PLO ambassador here in D.C., and many other distinguished guests will be speaking to us there. You can follow that at the hashtag Saban17. This is a special privilege, especially because it touches on something that I think is very fundamental to what we try to do at Brookings. As you may know, Brookings as an institution doesn't have an opinion or a policy stance on any policy or political issue. We, of course, as individuals in this institution certainly do, and we share them widely. We often disagree with each other, and we enjoy that disagreement. We enjoy it because it's based on a constructive debate that takes one belief the institution does have very seriously. It's a contentious belief these days, but we truly do believe that facts exist. And because we think facts exist, we think they are the only serious basis for policy recommendations, for policy analysis. And so the best of our work is one that is based on these kinds of facts, on rigorous social science and other science, natural science as well, and tries to produce from them the best policy recommendations we can have. There is no better example, to my mind, than exactly these polls that Shibli Tilhami does. Shibli is a non-resident senior fellow with us, but he's much more than non-resident. He's been with us and has been a pillar of the Center for Middle East Policy since its very beginning, when it was founded by Martin Indyk, and has been a friend, an inspiration, a senior colleague to me and many of us here, and so it's really a special privilege in that regard. And these data, are ones that every year I truly use throughout the year. I cite them in closed and open sessions all the time, and I imagine that you will as well. There's often some of the best nuggets. Because this is done so frequently, or so regularly, I should say, there's also a special added value of timelines, of looking at data with the same research, with the same analysis sometimes over time. In the United States, in the Middle East, Israel, among Palestinians, among other Arab countries, and all over the world. It's also a special privilege for me that we have an excellent panel of discussants, two of whom happen to be my colleagues and friends. But I'll start with our guest, Ambassador Dan Shapiro. Thank you, Ambassador, for being with us. Ambassador Shapiro was President Obama's ambassador to Israel until last year, and is now associated with the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv, and is certainly no stranger to Washington, to policy and politics here, and thank you very much for joining. Suzanne Maloney, Deputy Director of the Foreign Policy Program, who is also our Iran maven, and the one I turn to for anything I need on JCPOA or anything else to do with Iran, will be speaking as well, especially on those aspects. And will be moderated by my friend Tamara Wittes, who needs no introduction here, and is an expert on certainly all things Israel and all things Middle East, actually, and just came back from testifying in Congress. And so with that, without further ado, let's turn to the more interesting part, and I'll invite Shibli up to the stage.
Thanks so much, Natan, for the generous introduction. But I do go back before the Middle East Institute. I preceded Martin at Brookings. I've been here for, associated with Brookings proudly for 22 years, actually, 1995. So a great relationship has been mutually beneficial. Always proud of it. Today I'm going to present to you some of the findings of a poll we just conducted earlier in November, just a month ago. I just want to say a couple of things about this poll, which is it's part of University of Maryland Critical Issues Poll. I direct that center, and my partner with Professor Stella Rouse, who is the associate director, we do a lot of polling, not just on the Middle East and foreign policy. In fact, this one is a huge poll. We're going to be releasing other parts of it. We even have a part on North Korea's nuclear issue that we're going to release in January with a Japanese partner, an NGO that is conducting a similar poll in Japan to see how public opinion in the U.S. and Japan differ on nuclear issues. We also probe domestic politics. So we have a study underway from this poll on the American dream, on things like reaction to the NFL kneeling and to fake news. So this is an extensive project, but I'm today releasing only the parts that pertain specifically to the Arab-Israeli issue and Middle East policy, particularly Iran. So that's what I'm going to show today. Let me just say a couple more things about methodology. All of these polls that we conduct are with Nielsen Scarborough, and they're all pretty large samples. This one is 2,000. They're online probabilistic panel. And not only is this a 2,000 size, but it's also it has an oversample of young people, 1,000 to 42. We wanted to make sure we net a large number to talk confidently about young people, as you know, and I mean by that 18 to 34. And one reason is that generally when you do polling in the U.S., you don't get as many responses among young people, so usually people upweight the data. And so we wanted to make sure we could speak confidently about young people, and we got an oversample of young people. We downweighted it, obviously. So let me start here with what I'm going to show today. Some of the questions that I have are about immediate issues, some procedural, some policy issues, and two are going to be trendline questions, where we're really questions we've been asking for a long time. We just want to see what's happening in American politics and how it's changing. And one of the things that I'm going to show is that how the partisan divide on the Israeli-Palestinian issue is growing. It's not only big, but it's growing. And although not on every single issue, as you'll see, partisanship is deep in America. And I would argue that historically, American attitudes toward the Israeli-Palestinian issue were less partisan. And now, of course, we have partisanship on almost every issue. But the story here is that this issue, the Israel-Palestine question, is no longer immune to that divide. And in fact, it's a deepening divide, and we'll talk about it in the conversation as to why that's happening. But on some issues, surprisingly, Americans come together, and we'll see. And on other issues, they're not quite as divided. So let me start with an issue that is important today, which is, as you know, the Trump administration is contemplating moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem based on what the president had promised during the campaign. As you know, other presidents have promised that, and clearly they didn't fulfill that. Now there's talk that the president may actually fulfill that in maybe even as early as this week. Some reports say it's hard to know for sure, but clearly that's an issue on the table. So let me explain to you how we proceed to explore this issue. First, we give them the narrative, and you can see the narrative. President Trump pledged during the 2016 presidential campaign to move the U.S. embassy in Israel from its current location, Tel Aviv, to Jerusalem. But like previous presidents, since Congress passed the 1995 Jerusalem Embassy Act, he has renewed a waiver that will temporarily keep the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv based on national security interests. Now, tell me the extent to which you agree or disagree with the following statement. So what we do on a question like this is a typical methodology that we pursue, which is on a question like that, we don't only ask one question. We present them with the argument of people who want it moved, and we present them with the argument of people who don't want it moved, and then we ask them the bottom line. Now that you've heard both arguments, What do you think? And so let me show you how people responded to the arguments. The first argument is the U.S. should immediately move its embassy to Jerusalem. The embassy should be located in Jerusalem to fulfill the president's pledge, and there is no national security reason to file an exception to the 1995 Jerusalem Embassy Act. Such an act would serve to demonstrate the commitment of the United States to the State of Israel and to its control over unified Jerusalem as its capital. Now, that's the argument that we present. Now, then we present the opposite argument. And by the way, as it says here, the options are randomized. So we sequence them in a random fashion. So one, you know, sometimes this comes first, sometimes the other option comes first. And this goes, by the way, for every one of the questions that I'm going to articulate. I'm not going to repeat myself because that's what we do, the process that we do it. So what's the answer to this? Here it is. Okay, so what you find is actually 57, the black line is the total number of all Americans. 57% disagree or somewhat disagree with that statement. Strongly disagree or somewhat disagree with that statement. Of course, you can see a partisan divide. 73% of Democrats disagree. 54% of Republicans agree with that statement as stated. This is not about the policy, it's just the argument. Then we follow with the following, which is the U.S. should not immediately move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. The international community, including the UN and European allies, have not accepted Israel's annexation of Jerusalem, which was occupied in the 1967 war. The U.S. government's position has been that the ultimate status of Jerusalem has to be agreed in negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians. If the U.S. were to move the embassy to Jerusalem, it would be violating international norms, harming important relationships worldwide, and generating anti-American sentiments among Arabs and Muslims globally. So that's the counter-argument that we hear in the debate. So what's the answer to that? Here you find that 65% the panelists agree with it, somewhat agree or strongly agree, 65%. And even interestingly, I'm going to look at the Republicans, okay, 54% of Republicans also agree with it. Now, by the way, that is not uncommon, meaning it's not uncommon when you present an argument for, an argument against, for people to say, well, you know, I could see this, and oh, yeah, and I could see this too. And you always have an overlap. I mean, we all sometimes divide it on issues that are very close and controversial. So that's not unusual at all. In fact, it's rather common. The question then is, when they're forced to choose, what do they choose? That's the bottom line. So we follow with another question, which is, having thought about it, do you support or oppose the United States immediately moving its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem? That's the bottom line. 63% say they oppose. So a majority of Americans, a strong majority of Americans, say they oppose it. You could see 81% of Democrats oppose it. 60% of independents oppose it. Republicans, remarkably, are divided, actually, almost down the middle, you know, 49% to 44%. So even Republicans are not strongly in favor of moving the embassy, and that's really an interesting part of the story. Now, we asked a similar question, by the way, about the UNESCO because it was in the news, the withdrawal from the UNESCO over its being accused of bias against Israel and withdrawing from that institution. We also give two arguments for and against. So here, the U.S. participating in UNESCO is important. Even when the U.S. disagrees with some UNESCO policies, it demonstrates engagement in the international community and ensures the health of UNESCO, et cetera, et cetera. So we give an argument against withdrawing. Remember, again, these options are randomized. So the fact that I start with one doesn't mean everybody sees that as the first one. That's true of all of them. So here's the answer. So you get 62% who agree at least somewhat with this statement, that even when we disagree with the UNESCO, it's important for the U.S. to stay in the UNESCO. We then present an argument against for withdrawing from the UNESCO. So the U.S. cannot accept UNESCO's approach on Israel and Israeli-Palestinian conflict. UNESCO's disregard for Israeli positions justify U.S. withdrawal from membership in the organization. And we find here that overall, you know, there's more of a divide, and it's really a question of a divide along partisan lines, very much along partisan lines. This is really interesting. The minute you mention the term Israeli, I'm going to come back to this about the polarization. 71% of Republicans essentially strongly agree or somewhat agree, and then 71% of Democrats strongly disagree or somewhat disagree. But then here's the bottom line. So the bottom line is, all right, now you've heard both what should the U.S. do, and you have 55% say they oppose withdrawal from the UNESCO. Obviously, along partisan line, a very large majority of Democrats, Republicans oppose, but still in large numbers, but not as large on some issues that you have. That's why, and certainly independents more opposed than support this issue. The young people, clearly young people oppose it even more, 61% versus 53% for those 35 and over. The next question is mediating. President Trump has commenced efforts to mediate the Israeli-Palestinian, the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. His effort has relied on active personal diplomacy involving his top advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and his former lawyer, Jason Greenblatt. Tell me how much you agree and disagree with the following statements. So here, this is procedural. It's obviously in the news. We wanted to probe, in a way, the partisanship issue, whether the partisan issue even can affect something like this, where this is not really a policy. It's about process. Whether or not the partisanship is as deep being reflected in such a question. So we start, we give the following option. It is wise for presidents to rely on family members and people who are close to them in Middle East diplomacy, as that increases the confidence of Middle East leaders in the president's effort. There are people who make that argument, including, by the way, former President Jimmy Carter, who actually made that argument that, you know, Middle East leaders like to talk to people who are close to the president. And so we give that as an option. And what we see here is, even as we give that option, the strong majority disagree with it. You have 69% disagree with it as an option, including a slight majority. You know, the Republicans are evenly divided on this one, obviously, 49% to 47%. And then we give the alternative argument, which is, in complex diplomatic efforts such as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it is best for presidents to rely principally on experts who have knowledge and experience of both parties in the conflict. And here you have the overwhelming majority of Americans on every party. Look at that. There are no partisan differences on this one. You know, 83% agree with it. Then now that they've thought about it, say, now tell me which of the following do you agree with more, which one of those statements, and here you have the overwhelming majority of Americans agree that it's better to rely on experts. So you have including 71% of Republicans. Now, make that what you want of it, but it's interesting to me here that the partisanship is not transferring into such issues. This is not a policy issue per se. In general, what role do you want the new Trump administration to play in mediating the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? By the way, this is a tracking. We asked that last November after the election. And we ask it, and we also have a long history of asking a similar question about U.S. policy. So we track this to see. The first time I asked this was almost 30 years ago, this kind of question. So we have a long track record of figuring out, you know, so how is the American public opinion shifting? And this is, remember what I said up front, that this issue is no longer immune to partisanship. In fact, that partisanship is growing. But let me tell you, the options that we have historically given are straightforward. Lean toward Israel, lean toward the Palestinians, lean toward neither side. We don't say be pro. Lean is a little bit more, kind of muted, and we use that we've used that, but that's exactly the wording we've used in the past. So we have good tracking of this. So you can see that 59% of Americans want the U.S. to take neither side. 34% want to take Israel's side. Obviously, only few want to take the Palestinian side, 6%. So generally, the choice is between neutrality and taking Israel's side in this overall. And that is not unusual. This has actually been the history of American attitudes on this issue has been that a majority of Americans throughout, ranging from two-thirds to three-quarters, have wanted the U.S. to take neither side. It is that among those minority who want the U.S. to take sides, a lot more people want the U.S. to take Israel's side than the Palestinian side. That has been always the trend. But I want to show you, once you break that down, how that trend, where you see the partisanship. So look at this. So here, if you look at, let me just see the, this is the data comparing 2016 with 2017. This is a year ago when we released that data here a year ago. You could look, lean toward Israel among Republicans, among Democrats. Among Republicans, slightly grew from 56% to 58% of people who want to say straightforward, they want the U.S. to take Israel's side. And it increased a little bit, but still within the margin of error, so it's really not much of an increase. But look at Democrats. You have people who want to lean toward neither side went up from 69 to 77. And the people who wanted to take Israel's side has declined from 17% to 13%. So you see that in that data. And this is especially telling when you look at 35 and over versus 18 to 34. This is overall more of the younger people want to be even-handed. But look at young Democrats. Which is really an interesting story because it tells you the story about Democrats. Here the story is that when you look at the bottom line, you could say that the third category, lean toward neither side, it went 73% for 18 to 34 versus 78% for 35 or over. But look where the difference went. That difference went in favor of being leaning toward the Palestinians. So you have among young Democrats, the number of people who want to be pro-Israel are the exact same number of people who want to be pro-Palestinian, 13% and 13%, which is really, you can't get any more neutral and divided on this issue than what we see among young Democrats. Now, we ask a question, we ask them, of course, what they want the Trump administration to do, but now we ask, what do they think it is, in fact, doing? All right, so the question initially, we had 59% saying they want the U.S. to take neither side. So what do they think Trump is, in fact, doing? Well, they think, here's one place where Democrats and Republicans agree, pretty much the same numbers within the margin of error. Or roughly within the margin of error. The margin of error is about 2.19 for this poll. So a majority, 57%, think that it's actually taken Israel's side, not being even-handed. One of the issues of tension between the United States and Israel has been its construction of Israeli settlements. We tell that narrative. This is, again, a story that we have been tracking for several years, trying to figure out what Americans want to do about settlements. So we give them the option, how do you believe the U.S. should react to new settlements? So the options that we have given, there are really four options. They're combined here. One option is do nothing. One option is limit U.S. opposition to words, but take no other action, impose economic sanctions, or take even more serious actions. And here you could see that overall, 53%, a slight majority of Americans, believes that the U.S. Should do nothing or limit opposition to words. But the story, again, is on the partisan divide. By the way, this is the number If you look at it even aggregately, comparing from when we started this particular question, November 14, to November 17, in November 13, you had 60% say pretty much do nothing. 38% say sanctions or tougher action. That went up to 43%, which has been consistent with what we found over the last year, by the way. Pretty much consistent. This is not the first time we find this. And on the divide, that's where the story is. That's really where the story is. So if you look at Democrats in the dark, the brown color, 2014 versus the yellow color, 2017, look in the middle with the Democrats who want to impose sanctions or harsher measures. It went up from 48% in 2014 to 57% over the past year. So that is really an interesting issue. And, of course, it is an issue for the Democratic Party because that's not where the leadership is. That's where the constituents are. And it's been an interesting space for politicians to navigate. One reason why it probably has not been a major issue for the Democrats per se is that this is not a top priority issue for most of them. If it were, it would be a different story. And when it flares up and rises to the top, then it becomes an issue. But in the background, it's not one of the top priorities for most people. All right, just very quickly, I'm going to go through two more findings, and then I'll invite the panelists to join me. The attitudes on Iran, we asked a couple of questions. As you know, this issue has been in the news following the president's action. And so what we asked a couple of questions about how they feel about the Iran deal. It's really kind of we thought hard about how we might ask these questions in a way that, we know that the public probably doesn't have a lot of information on this, and so we tried to figure out where their instinct is on this. So we asked a couple of simple questions, and then we asked them specifically about the president's decertification, whether they agreed with it or not, just a straightforward question. So in this particular case, we asked them if the Iran nuclear deal, assuming that both sides comply, okay, obviously assuming that both sides comply, whether they think it reduces the chance that Iran will develop nuclear weapons. So here you have 55% say yes, they think it will. 40% say no. But again, look at the partisan divide. A strong majority of Democrats, 70%, say yes. Republicans are a majority say no, not as strong a majority, but a majority say no. But then in the next question, which is, it serves the national security interest of the United States as a broader theme than just the Iran's capacity to build nuclear weapons. Here we have actually more support for this. 70% of Americans agree with this, that it actually serves the national security interest of the United States, including, interestingly, 61% of Republicans. Then we ask... we asked them what if Congress is going to that Congress may be contemplating imposing additional sanctions on the nuclear issue. Obviously, Congress, as you know, can impose sanctions on unrelated issues, but on this issue, being a violation of the agreement. So the question is, what should the U.S. if Congress is considering that, what should they consider most? Okay, so what kind of signals should they look for? So we have the first one is that U.S. national security agencies, and we specify actually Pentagon, CIA, State Department, just to be very clear, find evidence that Iran is not complying with the nuclear deal. Okay, so that gets very strong support. If in fact that's what the agencies find, you get 73% say, then there's reason that's an issue to consider in imposing sanctions. We look at the next one, which is the national security agencies determine that imposing sanctions is in the U.S. national security interest. We also get support, 78% support that. Then we present if other deal signatories, and we specify them, also agree with imposing sanctions, so consensus kind of position. And here, again, we get 64% say, yeah, that we, they should consider that as well, but obviously not as large numbers. Then if imposing such sanctions help make Israel more secure, specifically, well, a majority says yes, but it's much more divided, 54% to 40% on that one. And the same thing with Arab countries. So we ask the question, if imposing such sanctions helps make Iran's Arab neighbors more secure, and we also get 57% to 37% say yes. And then when we ask them to rank these, now that they've thought about them, rank them individually, which one is most important, we get exactly the same ranking that you just saw in terms of how they value them. The top one is, you know, being the top two, actually, that national security agencies say Iran violated or it's in America's national interest. The next one is that there's consensus among the signatories. And then you could see that Israeli and Arab interests come next. It doesn't mean they're not important, as you could see. You know, when we ask them individually, they're still a majority say it's important, but they don't rank them as high in comparison to the others. Question about the decertification, whether or not they agree with it or not, very straightforward question. And here, you know, again, you can the most interesting part is that how many people said they don't know. We rarely get that in these kind of polls. We have usually people have opinion. On this one, you could tell the public is confused. They don't know. Of course, this is not about, you know, they don't even know whether we're violating the deal. It's just about certification versus decertification. So the fact that we have 27% don't know is really telling. And then the rest of the public is divided. 37% disapprove of the decertification. 35% approve, really a tie. And of course, look at the partisan divide, 68%. Well, the president did it, must be right. And the Democrats, the president did it, must not be right. And that's what we have here. Okay, final question, final issue is Russia. Let me tell you why we did, you know, why I'm including Russia, because obviously there are a lot of questions about whether the U.S. should cooperate with Russia despite what they have done in our election on matters related to the Middle East, whether it's the Arab-Israeli issue, Syria, and elsewhere. I wanted to see where the public is. But in order to do that, I wanted to find out, well, what they thought of the Russian role at home first to see whether they support it or not. And so we asked the question, do you believe that Russia interfered in the recent presidential election? And if so, did it influence the outcome? So we gave them three options. One is no, they did not interfere. One is they probably interfered but did not alter the outcome. And then one where they interfered and altered the outcome. Now, again, you can see there's a huge partisan divide, not surprisingly. But interestingly, overall, only 12% say Russia didn't interfere in our election. So that's become part of conventional wisdom for America, is they interfered. The question is whether it made a difference or not. More people think it made a difference, 41%, and 36% say it didn't make a difference. So they start off with, yeah, Russia did interfere with our elections. That's obvious. And then, do you view Russia as a foe or an ally? Well, it's interesting because actually the largest number, plurality, 47%, say it's neither a foe nor an ally. But only 11% say it's an ally. 42% say it's an enemy. So given that, do they think that the U.S. and Russia should cooperate, at least somewhat cooperate, on issues like terrorism, especially ISIS and al-Qaeda? Well, if you look at this number here, it's not combined here for some reason. I thought that was combined. Let me just double check, but it doesn't matter. Let's look at it. So it's somewhat desirable. Only 10% say it's not desirable at all. The overwhelming majority of Americans of all parties think that it's at least somewhat desirable to cooperate with Russia on ISIS. On the North Korea issue, just to take a question outside the Middle East, You also have only 12% say not desirable to cooperate, at least somewhat desirable, overwhelming majority. On dealing with the Iran issue, the same story. Only 3% say it's not desirable. And on the Arab-Israeli issue, I believe that's the Arab-Israeli issue, yes, actually, interestingly, slightly more people say they don't want Russia to cooperate. I've got to figure out to tease that out more, but it's still a 19% only to see where that is. So on Syria, the same thing, achieving stability on Syria, overwhelmingly yes. On Libya, overwhelmingly yes. So the story is that despite the fact that Americans believe that Russia interfered in the election, overwhelming majority of Americans, Republicans and Democrats, and despite the fact that only 11 or 12% believe that it is actually an ally, the overwhelming majority actually think the U.S. should find a way to cooperate with Russia on some of those critical issues facing the U.S. in the Middle East. And maybe the president knows something we have been missing on this one. Thank you very much. I invite the panelists to join.
Can you hear me? Okay. We're going to get everyone set up with their microphones here. And Shibley, first let me thank you for a wide-ranging and fascinating set of results. I am a fast tweeter, and I had a hard time keeping up with you. But I think that one of the recurrent themes of the polling that you've done on American attitudes toward the Middle East over the last several years is this issue of partisan differences. And in past years, you have taken pains to note that the partisan differences with respect to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict are not about Israel. The vast majority of Americans see Israel as a strategic ally. It's about the conflict. And in some of your earlier polling, you've dug into the constituencies within the Democratic Party and within the Republican Party that drive these partisan differences. In other words, that evangelicals are driving Republican opinion and blacks and Hispanics are driving Democratic opinion. So what looks like a partisan difference is actually a tribal difference, if you will, in certain ways. But today you seemed to be making a broader point about partisanship and the way that it's growing around this set of issues. So I want to give you a chance to talk about what's changed. Mm-hmm. What do you see that's changed in the data, and what does it tell us?
All right. There are really two kind of big issues related to the Democratic position specifically on this on the Arab-Israeli issue. One is the identity of the Democrats that have identified, you know, egalitarianism, more international law, more equitable. And that's reflected in demographic changes within the Democratic Party, African Americans, more Hispanics, women, younger people with those kind of attitudes.
If I remember right, a couple years ago, your polling showed that that Democrats and specifically African Americans and Latinos looked at the conflict through the lens of human rights. And that drove
partly,
some of the attitude.
Partly true, that human rights or egalitarianism, actually more broadly, is driving part of the identity. So there is a trend in the Democratic Party that's connected. And this issue, the Palestinian-Israeli issue, has become a symbol of it in some ways for a lot of the activists for a variety of reasons. But that doesn't explain why you would have big changes over 1 year or 2 years. Because those are trends where you'd expect the change to take time. Mm-hmm. So what is driving the short-term change? And there, I think, it is really our deep partisanship. What do I mean by that? That Israel has become a symbol of partisanship. Why do I say that? When people think Netanyahu, they think Republican. And why is that? Well, there are a lot of reasons for it. It's not just because we've had a right-wing Israeli government that has been closer to the Republicans in some ways than to the Democrats, but because particularly of the high-profile issue that mobilized the Democrats over the past few years, particularly the Iran nuclear deal, where there was direct intervention by the Prime Minister of Israel, where in the poll that I released a year ago, if you recall, Netanyahu was considered to be the most popular leader among Republicans of all world leaders, and particularly among the evangelicals. And so in some ways, there is this symbolism, the partisanship. In a way, if you recall, I also released at the same time a question about how is it that in our anti-Islamic rhetoric mood, we've had American public opinion improve toward Muslims, because it can't be profound. People suddenly discovered Muslim and learned more about them. And it was more about, you know, Democrats saying Trump is against it, you know, Trump,
for it.
I'm for it.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, yes, that's part of what's going on.
So it's less about the substance of the issues and more about how Americans read that issue relative to their own partisan identification.
No, that's not what I would say. I would say it's both. Because the reason why I would say it's both, because even separate from this change that we've seen, let's say, over the past year or the year before, we have seen a trend in that direction that is substantively related. By substantively related, I mean, when I say it's egalitarian and human rights, they are making an evaluation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, whereas they're saying occupation is unjust, or they're saying the fact that Palestinians don't have a state is unjust, or the fact that what's happening in Gaza is unjust. So people are making some judgments that are fit into their frame of mind and their own identity about feeling they're egalitarian or they're feeling that they're for human rights. So it's that plus the more intensive polarization now that explains the short-term bumps that we see.
Thank you. I appreciate your taking the time to unpack that for us, because it's a very complex and very controversial issue. And Dan, I want to ask you to reflect on this a little bit, since you were the U.S. Ambassador in Tel Aviv during that period of intense partisan debate over the Iran deal. The Israeli government firmly opposed, in fact, a majority of Israelis opposed to the Iran deal. And so the Israeli policy position sort of got inserted into a domestic American highly partisan debate in ways that we hadn't seen before. So from where you've been sitting, how does this growing partisanship over Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in particular play out for Israelis and their attitudes toward the United States?
It was probably easier during perhaps the Obama presidency, when the President Obama, for reasons that I think are well understood and were somewhat a cause of regret for me, was not as popular among Israelis as some other presidents have been, although I think sometimes that's overstated, actually. But it was easier to sort of say, right now we have somebody in the White House who doesn't get the Middle East the way we do, who is more sympathetic to the Palestinians than we're accustomed to, and to dismiss those things. One of the things that is so interesting about the reaction to the Trump policy is that they have absorbed it, even though the policy in many ways is not so different. When President Trump was elected, after the election, there was almost a celebration among Israelis on the right, advocates for settlements, many in the coalition itself, who thought this meant the end of the U.S. pursuit of a two-state solution and the end of any opposition to Israeli settlement activity. And in fact, that was the Knesset legislation that was advancing. It was the atmosphere in which the UN Security Council resolution came to vote. Once the president came into office and reverted to something that looks a lot more like traditional U.S. policy, whether or not he uses the words two-state solution, the other elements of what he's describing of a peace agreement.
I want
agreement,
you to hold back on settlements
hold
a little
back
bit.
Hold back on settlements a little
thing.
Bit and
yeah.
A peace agreement reached through negotiations that meets Israel's security needs and Palestinian self-determination and opens Israel's relations to the Arab world. I'm pretty sure he's talking about a two-state solution by whatever name one calls it. And quieter, but still nevertheless real pressure on settlement activity, to the point where there's a lot of resistance and disappointment coming out of that same group. So I think there's a certain discovery that U.S. interests are actually rather durable and not so defined on partisan terms by the administration. We'll see, of course, what they present as a peace plan in the coming weeks, or what we hear from Jared Kushner tomorrow. But that, I think, has been a little bit of a splash of cold water for some Israelis.
Great. We'll come back in a few minutes to the American debate over the Iran nuclear deal and sort of the echoes of that in our politics today and our policy today, particularly as American partners in the region are increasingly looking to Washington to push back on Iran in a variety of ways around the region. And we'll talk about what that means, what American public opinion means for the possibilities there. I'll just flag for now the end of your presentation, Shibley, noting that Americans want to work with Russia on this stuff. They don't want the United States to go it alone on this messy stuff in the Middle East, and that's a constraint that any American president is going to have to deal with. But before we go there, I want to stick with a symbolic issue, one that's been in the headlines the last few days, the prospect of moving the American embassy to Jerusalem. There was a report in the Israeli press a few days ago that the White House was about to announce its move. There are laws on the books in the United States that require the president either to move the embassy or to issue a national security waiver every 6 months. And the next waiver is due imminently. I think technically today is the deadline, although he may be able to string that another business day into next week or something. The White House has said no decision's been made yet. There's clearly an ongoing debate within the administration. And so now we have some public opinion that suggests that once they are presented with arguments for and against, Americans are not so hot on this idea. Even Republicans are divided on this. So I guess the first question is, why is the president so set on doing this?
Well, first of all, even though Republicans are divided, if he were to take a strong case in favor of it, that's the Republican support would be bumped up because they just because they want to support him. So clearly, and of course, more Democrats will oppose it at the same time. So you're going to have that effect. But the bottom line is, I spoke to one of his advisors on this issue. And the advisor said he feels obligated to fulfill his campaign promise. I said, well, you know, every president has made that promise. I don't really believe that is the core reason. I believe he's getting a lot of pressure from core constituencies. And we're talking about the Republicans. Of course, yes, the Republicans. But if you look at the president, remarkably, he's increasingly made evangelicals one of his core constituency. For a president who was not evangelical, who didn't initially receive the evangelical support, and as you know, I'm writing a book on that issue, that he is a, if you look at what he did on tax-exempt schools, what he's doing on
Roy Moore.
Yes, and all of these things, there's no question that this is a core constituency. And they are mobilized on this issue. They are telling him this is a priority one for them. So this is the one issue on the Middle East that he's actually feeling heat from his evangelical core.
Okay, and Dan, let me take this to you as well for a congressional perspective. You spent a lot of years on the Hill. And in fact, in Congress, that's where this law requiring the embassy to move came from, of course. For Congress, it was seen at the time as a nice symbolic win, but with the assumption that presidents would save us from ourselves. In other words, using the national security waiver would be a way of avoiding any drastic consequences in terms of a blow-up in ongoing negotiations or complications among some of our Arab partners. So, as we look at the politics of it today, where the president may actually decline to issue this waiver, what are folks in Congress thinking? Is this a moment where they say, gosh, we wish we hadn't played symbolic politics?
Well, it's already almost 20 years ago, so I'm not sure anybody's going to lose a lot of sleep over how they voted back then on it. It's true that the legislation included the very standard national security interest waiver, and it's been used almost routinely by Presidents Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump until in June of this year. What the purpose of that waiver was, though, as you said, was always to the logic was don't let moving the embassy, a desirable thing from the point of view of many in Congress and many other Americans, screw up the possibility of our broader interests being served by reaching a Middle East peace deal or just spoiling other relationships. Now, I did spend 5.5 years serving as our embassy in Tel Aviv, and almost every day I got in the car and we drove to Jerusalem, and I did my business with the Israeli government in all of their offices in West Jerusalem. So there's something a little bit phony or false about this whole issue.
You just park your car in Jerusalem and sort of get your satellite office?
The mobile embassy, the embassy mobile, maybe we'll call it. I actually think the real decision they need to face with this is, if we're going to do this, how do we do it in a way that advances our broader strategic goal, which is still to achieve a two-state solution? The biggest danger, and the reason the waiver was provided, was to avoid letting this decision, for whatever its merits, and there are merits because Jerusalem is Israel's capital, and the Jewish and Israeli people have a long-standing claim there and have their government based there. But there are complications to it. So that was the reason. But if you can find a way to move the embassy or declare your intent to do so, but at the same time make clear where it will be, it will almost certainly be in West Jerusalem, that East Jerusalem has a different status. We don't need to determine that status, but it's going to need to be negotiated. Palestinians have claims there. It's certainly possible, and almost every previous Middle East peace initiative that's gone into the details has suggested there would be some sharing of the city, maybe not divided by barbed wire and checkpoints, but with a Palestinian presence in the Arab neighborhoods of East Jerusalem, some arrangements for the holy sites, and Israeli maintaining its capital, West Jerusalem. There are ways you could describe this and frame this that actually advance the broader strategic objective and give Israel what it wants, what those members of Congress who voted for it want, which is to have our embassy operating in Jerusalem.
Allow me to add just one thing on this, because I think just to be clear on sort of what drives the decision. So, of course, we all speculate about how President Trump operates, so let's keep that in mind. You know, when I say, you know, there is pressure, including from the evangelicals, on him, that in itself doesn't fully explain it, because normally there is pressure on presidents, but the president has advisors who make a very strong case against that pressure, where they say this is going to do this and this and this in the Middle East and so forth. Now, he has his core advisors, obviously, including his son-in-law, who, you know, historically sympathize with that position. Their starting point, at least personal starting point, and they don't know a lot about the rest of the Arab world to make a case about the potential consequences. They get feedback, but frankly, the Arab feedback, while they tell them they're opposed to it, when they go into meetings with Trump and when they talk with Trump's staff, they want to win them over more than criticize them, even as they present their case in a soft way. And so for that reason, I think I'm not sure the president gets the point about what the consequences could be.
Mm-hmm. It's noteworthy that King Abdullah of Jordan has been in town this week. He, when President Trump was first inaugurated, there was a thought that he might announce an embassy move right away. King Abdullah made a quick unscheduled trip to Washington, apparently to discuss precisely that issue. President Trump then issued the waiver, did not move the embassy, issued the waiver in June, and King Abdullah was back in town this week, so we can guess what was at the top of his agenda. I want to turn now to another issue that I'm sure was on King Abdullah's agenda and is also very, very interesting in your poll results, Shibley, which is the Iran nuclear deal and, you know, the partisanship around this issue in the United States. It continues to be one where Democrats and Republicans are pretty dug in. And I found it very interesting that in the polling questions on under what conditions would it be worthwhile considering new sanctions on Iran, you had very unified views on the first three conditions. But then as soon as you put the word Israel into the question or Arab allies into the question, you got a partisan split in the results. What does that tell you?
Well, it's interesting because it does tell me that most Americans still think American national security first. When you know, because that's when you use the term American national security agencies.
Everyone says great. They still trust the intelligence community.
But the interesting thing here, though, is that the consensus among the signatories, which typically is not something that Americans care about as much, is at least certainly not on the right, seem to also rank higher.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to again stress the fact that while it does get a little partisan, there's still, if you look at it issue by issue, they still think that it's important to consider, at least a small majority of Americans, over 50%, that it's still important to consider Arab neighbors' interest and Israeli interest in this mix. It is just when you ask them to rank them, those are really much lower on the priorities than the other three.
Great. Thank you. And Suzanne, I want to bring you in at this point. You have written extensively about the agreement and its implications for Iran's role in the region. You also spent a lot of time in the midst of the debate over the nuclear deal talking to members of Congress, talking to their staffs, doing public speaking, doing media on this issue. So, first question, do any of the results that Shibley showed us today on this issue surprise you? And then secondly, if you are one of those American partners in the region who was unhappy about the nuclear deal, do these results make you feel like you're likely to see this deal stand or that Trump is going to come over to your side and maybe push against the deal?
Thank you. It's a really interesting question. And the answer to both sets of the question may be one and the same. I think what was perhaps not most surprising, but really interesting to me was the strong approval rates from Republicans for the president's decisions to decertify Iranian compliance with the nuclear agreement, contrasted with the strong disapproval rates among Democrats for that very same decision. And it's an interesting finding because what it does is reinforce the political wisdom of what the president did. There was no strategic value to taking this step, and I think that's why so many analysts were to some extent puzzled and frankly dismissive of this as a sort of gesture on the part of the president back on October 13th. He announced with great fanfare decertification, which has no actual immediate or direct implications for American adherence to its obligations under the JCPOA. What it does is set off a process in Congress for either reimposition of some of the statutory sanctions that were waived or suspended as a result of the deal, or, as the president really seemed to advocate, an amendment to the original review legislation for the nuclear agreement that might find a way to sort of reimpose American sanctions if Iran took any set of particular steps, including resuming its nuclear program after the expiration of the deal itself. So in effect, what the president was suggesting was that this might be a way to make the deal's penalties permanent for the Iranians. There's been very little traction around that on the Hill, but what you see is that clearly this resonates with Republican voters, and that is considered, I would imagine, a huge net positive for the White House. If I were, sort of sitting in either Israel or in some of the states of the Persian Gulf who were very vocal opponents of the nuclear agreement at the start, what I would worry about from, I think, the findings of this poll is that there is still, among the American public, some sense of confidence in, as you said, national security agencies, and in what we know to be the fairly universal assessment of both those agencies and the International Atomic Energy Agency and American partners in the deal, that Iran is in fact complying with the agreement. That seems to matter, at least in terms of public opinion. And in a sense, it creates, I think, a complication for the president to actually take any steps to walk away from the agreement itself.
Okay, so the agreement itself, Americans seem to be happy to live with, but the symbolic politics are still working for the White House. Dan, I want to turn to you in this because I think that the Israeli government is amongst those who, during this period of debate over whether Trump would certify compliance, took the view that that questioning the deal was a way of gaining leverage on Iran more broadly. How are Israelis reacting to a step that seems to have had no practical implications when they are still very concerned about Iranian behavior in the region?
So the emotional impact, of course, of the decertification was similar maybe to what the polling shows the president's supporters, Republicans, tended to feel. There was a certain validation of the fears and the criticism that the prime minister had led, and many Israelis agreed about the terms of the deal. But you know, since it has no practical effect, where that leads is still very much a question. And, of course, the prime minister himself has adopted a slogan of fix it or nix it. But, of course, those are two completely different strategies, right? And so fixing it, amending it, trying to find ways to extend the sunset clauses, trying to strengthen the inspection protocols to make sure there's access in military sites, in other ways, and, of course, building pressure on Iran against its non-nuclear activities, those are things that I think many in the region could get around, many, I think, on a bipartisan basis here could get around and would allow us, with unity with European partners, to try to bring Iran to accept some terms that we probably were always going to need to come back to. This deal was never the perfect deal. It never ended the Iranian nuclear program. It bought time. And maybe there's a way to extend to buy no term. But nixing it, canceling it, is almost the exact opposite. It's to, as the president said he might do if Congress doesn't act, terminate our participation in it. Iran essentially released from its obligations in that situation. And we would have, I think, no chance of an internationally unified community to try to reimpose sanctions or go back to Iran. They could resume all the aspects of the program that have been suspended or rolled back under the deal. So I think Israelis are still puzzling through this question of, even though the emotionally satisfying aspect has now been achieved, what's the practical policy that will have the best impact? And a signal of that might be when Prime Minister Netanyahu was in London about a month ago, and he met with Prime Minister May, and he came into that meeting and said, you know, I was talking about canceling the deal. I'm now much more focused on fixing, improving, strengthening, extending the deal. That's certainly the right approach with the Europeans, but I think as a, on a practical matter, I think a lot of Israelis are going to discover that it's actually the right approach for their own interests as well.
Suzanne, I want to come back to you on this point because a lot of our debate about the Iran negotiations, about Iran in general in the United States, is focused on this idea of, can we empower moderates in Iran? Are we empowering radicals in Iran? Are we playing into the hands of the hardliners? And, you know, looking at the partisan divide on Iran in the United States when and the rhetoric of the president and his administration, one could expect that Iranians might be making some of the same calculations about the United States. Do you think that this sort of sharp divide and the heated rhetoric from the White House about not just Iran's, not just the nuclear deal, but Iranian behavior more broadly, does this have the effect of making Iran hesitate at all in its regional behavior? Does it make Iran perhaps more willing to consider amendments to the nuclear deal?
I don't think it does in the short term. It certainly vindicates the narrative of hardliners and of the Supreme Leader that the United States is not to be trusted, that there is no possibility of a broader negotiation or certainly not a broader rapprochement with Washington because there is just an implacable animosity toward the Islamic Republic here in Washington. I do think that the sense of uncertainty around the future of the deal, as well as the sort of corresponding uncertainty around what, if anything, the Trump administration is prepared to do about Iran's extension of influence around the region, Iran's involvement in conflicts in Syria, Yemen, and elsewhere, has given the Iranians a couple of somewhat countervailing pressures. One is there's a clear consensus expressed across the political spectrum by Iranian leaders that Tehran does not want to be the bad guy with respect to the future of the deal. The Iranians are very cognizant of the utility of their burgeoning rehabilitation in terms of the international community and the revitalization of their diplomatic and economic relationships with Europe, and they want to protect those. So if anything happens with the deal, they're not going to be the first to take a step to undermine it. On the other hand, the Iranians also recognize that as U.S. pressure, at least rhetorically and potentially on the ground, begins to intensify, that their own sort of impetus is to push back. The best defense is a good offense. They really want to make clear that Iran is, if anything, a stronger power in the region today than it was when President Obama left office. And they want the Trump administration to understand that very clearly. And so I think you have these sort of countervailing pressures on the Iranian leadership, and it may play out in a very erratic fashion in terms of the way we see things on the ground.
May I add a connection? Because, you know, one question that you asked, it's excellent about how the Iranians see it, but think about it also in the context of North Korea and Iran mm-hmm. and the impact on each. So if you're sitting in North Korea, and if the Iranians are saying the U.S. is not to be trusted with a deal, think about what North Korea might do, and think about what Iran might draw from the fact that North Korea now has the capacity to hit American soil, was changing the nature of the relationship, maybe opening, actually, maybe there's an opening for negotiations, as some suggested, because the leadership there has said, we've now completed, and they had said, we're not going to start before we completed our program. So if I would compare the two, mm-hmm. I know that there'll be consequences, both in Tehran and I'm certainly in North Korea.
Thanks. So I want to come back around to American domestic politics. We've talked a lot about Trump and how these political differences are shaping his policies. But we've got midterms, congressional midterm elections coming up next year, and Democrats and Republicans both dealing with a White House that is unpredictable, to say the least, on foreign policy. We've seen Congress play a much bigger role in foreign policy debates over this first year of the Trump administration. And now members of Congress are going into a year where they're thinking primarily about reelection and how they want to position themselves for their best advantage in the race that's coming. It strikes me that the America First rhetoric really cuts in two different contradictory directions when it comes to America's role in the world. On the one hand, it's selfish and self-interested, and all these big global problems aren't our problem. So just let them figure this stuff out themselves. We're not going to do everything for everybody else. On the other hand, there is a kind of bellicosity and a confrontational approach on a lot of issues, especially in the Middle East, and certainly when it comes to fighting terrorism and confronting Iran. And so here we come to sort of the last section of your poll results today, Shibley, and the idea of cooperating with Russia on these thorny Middle East security issues and on North Korea as well. And some of your other earlier poll data, which shows that Americans are still pretty tired of intensive American engagement in the Middle East, and they would like to do less. As you look at this latest set of results, what does it tell you about kind of what the American political traffic can bear if you're a member of Congress who wants to distinguish himself, perhaps, from the president?
Well, I mean, part of the problem in answering that question is that the Democrats have made the Russia issue such a featured issue in their politics. And so it's really hard to analyze it strategically. I mean, for good reason, obviously. There was intervention in our election. It probably mattered, and it should be investigated. But nonetheless, it's become so tied to politics that it's very hard. So if you are entering the new election, if that's going to be a featured issue for Democrats in the election, I think there's some tough space there where, I think the public don't necessarily see Russia as an enemy. There are only 40-some percent who see Russia as a foe. And they want some cooperation. So it's a nuanced space. I think.
Well, as you said to me earlier, Americans don't like Putin, but they like him more than they like ISIS.
They like him more than they like ISIS. They like him more than they like Assad. They like him more than they like a lot of other things. And so, so I think that's the thing where we should start. I don't also know how much foreign policy is going to be part of the election. I mean, now we have there's an excellent column today by Fareed Zakaria in the Washington Post about how is it that many of the core constituents of Trump who stand to lose big in the tax reform still support it, whether they're just being blinded or whether they really care more about identity issue than they care about economics. And that, I think, is the big story of our time. I think it's bigger than foreign policy. And we're going to have to, think about it deep and hard.
Thank you. Dan, I want to come to you on this. You were a very successful foreign policy advisor for a very successful presidential candidate and spent a lot of time working with members of Congress on domestic politics and foreign policy and how to position themselves. So as you think about how the Democratic Party and Democratic members have been positioning themselves on Russia, on, engagement in the Middle East, the war on terror, they, for the most part, have taken a strong internationalist stance, a stance in opposition to the White House, but they've really doubled down on these foreign policy issues. When you look at Shibley's results, does it make you uneasy at all for those Democratic members? How would you advise them?
I don't think, first of all, I think internationalism in the sense of maintaining alliances, of being actively engaged, of trying to help resolve conflicts with partners carrying their share of the burden.
But not American leadership.
I think that remains popular, and I would hope most members of Congress would approach it because I think it's the right thing to do, but also I think it's something that they can describe with a compelling narrative to their constituencies. I'm much less certain that there's support for intervention if we're talking about significant military engagement. We're still a decade and a half from the beginning of Afghanistan and Iraq wars. Those losses are still weigh very heavily. A campaign against ISIS, which was mostly conducted from the air with the boots on the ground being Kurdish and Sunni Arab allies, is one thing, mm-hmm. but to actually be pulled more deeply into the kind of military engagement it might be required to really confront Iran and Syria as it tries to take advantage of ISIS's defeat and Russia sponsors it, or wherever else they're operating the region, I'm much less certain there's a strong American appetite for that. What I took from Shibley's results, it just flashed by at the end, but the question about Russia related to Syria really made sense to me in that context, that a lot of Americans, if they can figure out a way to have Russia help us stabilize Syria, which means we don't have to sort of go in and try to do it ourselves, that's preferable. Obviously, I think from some of our allies in the region, Israelis, but also some Gulf Arabs, that's unnerving because Russia's friends are not their friends, Hezbollah and Assad and Iran and so forth. We might agree, and the American people might be willing to agree, to terms that are not sufficiently robust, leaving them to feel like they have to act on their own. And I think, frankly, again, where I'm sitting now, what I hear from Israelis is they do feel they have to act on their own. They've already conducted their own airstrikes in Syria on many occasions. That's been publicly discussed by their own leadership. But I think they have a sense, they may feel the need to extend that freedom of action into a broader target set in Syria if Iran is coming in, and they won't necessarily have the United States involved. What they'll look for is legitimacy for that freedom of action, some diplomatic support with the Russians, but really expect to carry the burden on their own.
I remember at last year's Saban Forum, Defense Minister Lieberman saying in a public session that if he were forced to choose between having Iran on the Syrian side of the border with Israel or having ISIS, he would rather have ISIS. Here we are a year later, and it looks like the Israelis are getting the choice they
did not want.
I'm going to open it up to questions from all of you. There are microphones around the room. I'm going to do my best to be equitable in the geographic and gender distribution of questioners. No, it's not funny. And I am going to ask you to do three things. Number one, introduce yourself. Number two, state your question. And number three, note the way I phrased that. State your single question. Okay, we'll start right here on the aisle in the checkered shirt.
My name is Stephen Shore. One word that no one mentioned in this discussion about foreign policy is trade. And our president seems to view it as a zero-sum game, that in every bilateral relation, trading relation, one, there's a winner and a loser. So I'm wondering if the survey asked anyone questions about trade policies and agreements.
Thank you. Shibley, you had a lot more in there than you presented today.
About trade policy specifically? No, we didn't. We don't really have. We asked about a lot of other questions, like immigration, for example. We have on refugees, questions like that. We've done a lot. But we really don't ask much about economic issues. That's not part of our set.
Okay. Yes, sir, on the side.
Thank you. My name is Bill Clay. I wonder if Shibley could give us some more information, please, on the sample, its size, percentage Republican, Democrat, the growth or decline of those, whether the independents are center right, center left, and if he sees any bumps in the road that are he could predict along those lines.
Sure. Well, the sampling is done by Nielsen Scarborough. They choose a national representative sample of 2,000 from their panel, which is almost a 500,000 panel that they collect, originally recruited by phone and by mail. It is weighted along all the variables based on census data. With the partisan divide we've always done, we take the last 6 month average of Gallup's partisan divide, and we use that as a guide and consistently over time. So we compare it in the same way. And that's, of course, up out there on our website and also on the Nielsen Scarborough website when you go for the full detail of how they recruit the panel.
Thank you. Okay, next question right here.
Thank you, Abdelrahim Fuqara from Al Jazeera. I want to ask about something you indirectly maybe touched upon, but not directly, and that's the issue of democracy. The latest attack in the Sinai in Egypt, as I'm sure we're all aware, has touched off some sort of debate here in the United States whether the tight-grip, tight-fisted, iron-fisted policy in Egypt is the right policy, or if Sisi needs to open up. In terms of American attitudes to the issue of democracy, I wonder if you could say something about whether what's happening in the Sinai, or what's happened, has done anything to those dynamics.
First of all, I hate to speculate because we didn't pull on that directly, but I can just give you sort of my orientation on this. I think my own view is that a lot of the attitudes on Egypt are going to be along partisan lines, in part because Trump is friendly with the government. The Egyptian government had an uneasy relationship with the Democratic Party. They don't really follow the narrative inside Egypt very closely, and so that you're going to find that kind of divide. My view is that other than the experts, those of us who follow it closely, and we can have this really nuanced conversation, is the policy fueling more terrorism, or is it reducing terrorism? A legitimate one, we should have that, and I know you're going to have that on Al Jazeera this afternoon. The question, of course, is for most Americans, they don't follow that, and so I think it actually garners more sympathy for Egypt overall, because when they look at the horror of this attack and what you see, you know, and also the storyline behind it, the targeting of a mosque, maybe because it was frequented by Sufis, that storyline is. So I would think that it garners actually more sympathy with Egypt in general. Even though it'll still be a cross-partisan line, but it will generate a really powerful conversation among experts. for sure, as it is in Egypt itself.
Shibley, if I may, just given the results that you've garnered in earlier polls about attitudes on human rights, on international law, and the partisan differences on that, do you think that there's space to make arguments for and against Trump's embrace of dictators in American domestic politics? Is that something Democrats might be able to pick up on?
Here's something that I want to say, and so an article I'm actually writing. We talk about the clash of civilization, but the reality of the biggest clash right now is within civilizations. Within America, the differences between Republicans and Democrats on matters that are related to the Muslim world, like the Muslim ban, are greater than the divide between the United States and Egypt, between the United States and Saudi Arabia. And inside these countries, the divide between the two groups, however you break it, is greater than the one across. So we have here something really, really complicated in terms of making the assessment. And yes, of course, I mean, I think the Democrats evaluate the Egyptian government partly on the human rights issue, partly on how it worked out with the Obama administration, and partly on being an ally or seen to be an ally of the Trump administration. It's exactly the opposite on the Republican side. Where independents are, I don't venture. I haven't actually polled that directly. But as typical in these polls, they're somewhere in between.
Thank you. We have a question in the white turtleneck there.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Leah Wiener from the Washington Institute for Near Race Policy. So I was wondering, you addressed the desertification of the JCPOA sort of in isolation, and I was wondering about
the
desertification of the JCPOA. And I was wondering what the partisan divide was on the more comprehensive U.S. approach to addressing Iranian regional threats and how those two pertain to each other.
I'm not following the question.
So you asked specifically attitudes toward the decertification decision on the JCPOA, but did you ask attitudes more broadly on the U.S. approach to Iran, on Trump's policy toward Iran?
Oh, okay, sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't hear that. We had a couple of other questions on Iran, but they didn't touch on that specifically. And if I recall correctly, there was nothing, they were... Part of the problem with asking these kind of questions, we struggled. You know, this is like on questions where you know the public isn't following very closely. You're trying to figure out, you know, what is it that they know and how you can get the most information from what you think they know. So we found that these questions that we asked them were the ones that kind of dealt with their level of where we thought they were, and we didn't introduce additional kind of variables into the conversation.
Thank you. Okay, let's see. In the back in the striped shirt.
Hello, I'm Megan Donahoe from Search for Common Ground, and I had a question for Suzanne, generally more about Iranian diplomacy at the moment, and I was wondering about your thoughts on Iran's stance in Yemen currently. Thank you.
Yeah, it's actually, as the conversation in the region has shifted from the nuclear issue to other dimensions of Iranian behavior, there are issues coming up, especially the war in Yemen, that haven't actually penetrated American public discussion very much, so...
Yeah, I think Yemen is more a case of non-diplomatic action on the part of the Iranians. It's an extension of Iranian influence through support to the Houthis via the Revolutionary Guard and other elements of the Iranian security bureaucracy. It's a fairly low-level priority, I think, for the Iranians. That seems to be the conventional wisdom, and it bears out in the sense that there seems to be a greater willingness on the part of the Iranians to engage around the issue of Yemen. But the difficulty at the moment, and it's a contrast from where the kind of regional dynamic was historically, there seems to be very little impetus on the part of the Saudi government to reciprocate or you know, sort of engage in any serious fashion over Yemen or any other issue that might involve Iran. And that stands in contrast from the way that the Saudi government handled this longstanding animosity and frictions with Iran, even during the Iran-Iraq War during the 1980s, when the Saudis were, you know, very much directly involved, when the relationship between Tehran and Riyadh was extremely problematic. The Saudis repeatedly sought to de-escalate with Iran and repeatedly issued overtures to Ayatollah Khomeini at that time, seeking to avoid a wider clash. And at this stage, I don't think there is an address in Riyadh that is terribly prepared to engage with the Iranians, and even where the Iranians somewhat untraditionally have been reaching out to the Saudis, they apparently are getting very little resonance. So unfortunately, you know, my sense is that there is very little pressure here because it hasn't become a very widespread public issue, and because the Trump administration appears to be trying to align itself more closely with the Saudi government and with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, for whom Yemen is a signature foreign policy move and perhaps a signature foreign policy disaster.
Thank you. You know, it's I think one of the big changes that we've seen with the new prominence of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is a shift in the Saudi approach from bet hedging in its relations with Iran, kind of balancing between confrontation and outreach. Now it's all in on confrontation. And we see that in Yemen. We see it in the recent dust-up over Saad Hariri's resignation as Prime Minister of Lebanon. And that move in Lebanon in particular kind of raised the prospect of heightened tensions between Israel and Hezbollah and the possibility of escalation to violent conflict. It seems to be a moment when in the region, our partners, American partners, are much more willing to contemplate confrontation, although none of them are looking for more war. And as Shibley's poll data shows us, Americans are still really not looking for more confrontation. We're still looking for less.
Again, Tammy, I think it's a little bit of a dissonance between the Trump style and the rhetoric and the decertification and the strong, tough talk, which resonates and people appreciate. Of course, the backing given to the Saudi Crown Prince is part of that. And the question of, well, what is that going to add up to on the ground? And where will the United States play? And so some of these partners, Israel perhaps in Syria, Saudi Arabia with Yemen, with Lebanon, with Qatar, are beginning to take matters into their own hands, although they're not necessarily totally coordinated themselves. If indeed Mohammed bin Salman was trying to accelerate what everyone assumes is the inevitable next war between Israel and Hezbollah, because he expects Israel is going to really bloody their nose very severely, I don't think the Israelis are looking to have that war. They're preparing for it, but they're also trying to postpone it as long as possible. Yep. So without a coordinator of this whole anti- or counter-Iran aggression coalition, which is needed, it can get very disorganized and people can go off in their own directions.
Isn't there also a risk of cross signals where the rhetoric from the White House suggests that we would encourage our partners in that kind of more assertive behavior, but it's not clear that we're going to back them up if they get in a jam, right?
Yeah.
Okay, last question, Gary Mitchell.
Thank you. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report, and I think I'm collecting my 12th or 13th star for attending Shibley's wonderful presentation. And I think I always try to sort of craft the question that appeals to the Yoda in Shibley, and that is having you there are lots of questions that you didn't speak to today. You go back a number of years. I'm wondering what two or three things you feel came out of this particular session, this particular polling session, that tell you something about what's going on that the rest of us may not either understand or that we misunderstand. You've spoken to some of that in your conversation, particularly opening comments with Tamara about the move from sort of polarization to tribalism. But what's your sense of what comes out of this that's not specific per se to Iran or to Israel or to moving the embassy?
Let me just say that we're going to release a study out of the poll pretty soon that includes questions that go more into the core of what's driving Americans, including a sense of whether they think the American dream is still alive or not, and try to connect some of the really deep questions to with policy questions to see if there's something driving, and we think there is, and we're in the process of preparing that. So these questions, of course, by themselves are a small part of something bigger, as I said. Even on North Korea, there's something interesting where, as Dan and Tamara had noted, of course, the American public is reluctant to get engaged militarily. But we see actually in what we're going to release, we have not released it yet, on North Korea, a greater accepting of military action by Republicans in this administration than there was before, including with countries like North Korea. So I think there is something going on, obviously, that I've always asked the question to myself, does the messaging from a president matter? Obviously, it does. It does in superficial ways, and it does in deep ways. The superficial ways is it does make people, you know, if you're a polarizing figure, a polarizing leader, it's just by virtue of taking a position, you're swaying public opinion one way or the other because you become the issue, not the substance of the issue. Mm-hmm. We see that very deeply here. But it's also more important because it may be that when people have uncertainty about what to do, they still go to the commander-in-chief for signals. And not everybody, but enough people, that it actually alters their position on the world. We saw that with George W. Bush after 9/11, how even people who didn't support him suddenly said, well, you're the commander-in-chief, tell us what to do. Yes, there was divide, but the divide was a lot less than it was the day before. And we see that that Trump is actually swaying Republican public opinion, not just keeping them on substantive issue. That's really interesting, and that's something to watch for. And I think Democrats are wrong to think that because of all the things that they have against him, the million things that they have against him, that he still can't win. And the reason for it is very simple, I think. He can still make a very strong argument on the same core issues that he ran on, that he's dismantling the establishment. He's breaking up into the sort of stuff. He said he's devastating the State Department.
He's well, about to shut down
exactly,
the government.
That's exactly what they want to hear. So I see something here, and the Russia is another story part of it. The Russia, yes, don't you see, it's really a problem. Yes, it is a problem, but don't make it your only central problem because that's not, the public is more nuanced on it. So that's kind of the general thing that I get out there, those people who are running by being just anti-Trump are missing something much bigger that is influencing public opinion.
Thank you, Shibley. Thanks to all of you for a fantastic discussion, and I hope that you'll follow the public portions of the Saban Forum program over the weekend. There will be webcasts on the Brookings website, and you can look on Twitter at the hashtag Saban17. Thank you so much. Thanks to our panel.